Extraordinary. I got very moved.
And interviews with the people creating and changing the world of arts around us.
I pay a lot of attention to lessons in the human condition that never cease to inspire me.
Join Tom Sutcliffe and me, Samira Ahmed, for Front Row.
Some of the lines that I write, I personally do actually really love.
Live every Monday to Thursday evening on Radio 4 at 7:15, with thousands of episodes now on BBC Sounds.
And on this evening's programme, we'll have reviews of the TV adaptation of the novel Daisy Jones and the Six and Lucas Daunt's new film, Close. That's at 7:15. Now on Radio 4, true stories and occasionally forthright opinions with a transatlantic angle.
Ladies and gentlemen, meet David Sedaris.
That was so kind of you to applaud like that. This is an essay that I wrote called Fresh Caught Haddock. When George Floyd was killed, and seemingly overnight, all of New York came to smell like fresh plywood, I thought of Schenectady. Why there? My sister Amy asked. She was with Hugh and me on the terrace of our apartment on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. From where we stood, we could hear the roiling cauldron 20 stories below us, sirens, shouting, the distant sounds of breaking glass, all blended together into a furious, muffled roar. Years ago, I was on a plane, seated next to a middle-aged black woman who was reading a Bible, I began. I was working a crossword puzzle, and said to the flight attendant, a white guy, not just gay, but a queen, "Excuse me, but do you know how to spell Schenectady?" He told me he had no idea. Just as I was sort of hating him for it, the woman with the Bible said, "Schenectady." She spelled it with her eyes shut, maybe to prove that she wasn't cheating. Amy spat an olive pit into her palm. "Oops, exactly," I said. Why hadn't I turned to her in the first place? I told myself I'd asked the flight attendant because it was his job to serve me. But how true was that, really? Did I ask him because he was white or because he wasn't reading a Bible? "What does that have to do with anything?" Amy asked. I shrugged. "I don't know. I guess I think that people who read Bibles on planes aren't all that smart." "I don't know that being smart really plays into it," Amy said. "I'm sure there are plenty of dummies in Schenectady who have no problem spelling their town's name. I mean, it's part of their address." She dropped the olive pit into a planter Hugh had just filled with pansies. "I can't spell Minneapolis or Minnesota. Does that make me stupid?" I said, "Yes." She sighed. "I know. I'm an idiot." Hugh headed indoors to make fresh drinks for himself and Amy. "I could have spelled Schenectady for you." "Yeah, well, you weren't there, were you?" I said. "You're never there when I really need you." He and I had just returned from 2 weeks at the C-section, our house on Emerald Isle. The New York we'd left behind us had already been changed by COVID-19, but now that we'd returned, it felt doubly different. For the first time since February, the virus was no longer the only news. The unrest was. The country had gone from one massive headline story to another, and it felt like anything might happen next. A cataclysmic natural disaster, an alien invasion. If I was overreacting, it was because New York had borne a bigger brunt of the year 2020 than many other places. North Carolina, for instance. "The coronavirus never happened on Emerald Isle," I told Amy. "Or, okay, it almost didn't happen. At the grocery stores, hardly anyone had a mask on. Same at the Dairy Queen. Coming from Manhattan, where we can't leave the house without our faces covered, it was a real, I'd planned to say shock. But what came out instead was vacation." "I want to go," Amy said. And so we made plans to return in a few weeks with her and her friend Adam. In the meantime, shops were being looted, and there were almost nonstop local protests, the moods of which varied from peaceful to confrontational. 5 months earlier, I'd been in Hong Kong and asked people about the pro-democracy demonstrations there, surprised to learn that if you lived in certain parts of town and avoided your television, you could easily know nothing about them. That was certainly not the case in New York, where no matter your neighborhood, the protests were impossible to ignore. I walked downtown the day after Amy came for dinner and fell upon a crowd that had gathered in Union Square. A number of people had signs, but before I could make them out, I was stopped by a young woman with green hair who wanted to hand me a plastic bottle. "Water, sir?" I shook my head no. "How about some hand sanitizer? Or I have chips if you need a little something to eat." I guessed she was a college student and assumed she was selling these things, but no, it seemed that they were free. "That's all right," I said, "but thanks." The crowd at the southern edge of the park wasn't doing anything in particular. Some of the people who had signs were hoisting them with no apparent sense of urgency in the direction of the police, who formed a ragged line on the other side of 14th Street, talking amongst themselves. Protest-wise, it seemed like a good place to get started. So I went to Amy's and returned with her half an hour later, noting as we wandered into the throng, we looked like we're searching for our children. Grandchildren was probably more like it, as we were by far the oldest people I saw. "Water?" an earnest woman with pigtails asked. "Do you want some pretzels? Something to keep your blood sugar up?" "Need a list of the local bathrooms?" another student-aged person asked, offering me a clearly marked map. This was nothing like what the TV news had been showing. Here, there were no crowbars, just candy bars, and chips and Cheetos and dried fruit slices. "Are you sure I can't give you a little something to eat?" asked the dogged young snacktivist. I reckon there were maybe 300 people in the park. Signs included "White silence, no more," "Defund NYPD, no excuse for abuse," and BLM, an abbreviation for Black Lives Matter. A person I couldn't see was beating a drum, and while it felt like something should kick off, nothing did. Every so often, applause would break out, though I was never sure why. "It's just a gathering, really," the young woman standing next to me explained. She had a ring in her nose, and like most everyone else around us, she was white. It's an odd spot to occupy, the ally. On some website that morning, I'd watched a video of two identical-looking blondes spray-painting "I Can't Breathe" on the facade of a Starbucks in Los Angeles. "What are you doing?" a black protester shouted. "That's something I'm going to get blamed for, my people. Who asked you for your help anyway?" The girls stopped, but only because they were finished. In another video, a white guy with silver hair was using a pick, the sort gold miners hoist in movies, to break up paving stones he could hurl at the police. A black protester intervened, saying, much like the woman in L.A. had, that he was going to get blamed for it. But the guy with the pick continued until he was tackled to the ground by the black fellow and a few of his friends, who subsequently delivered him to the very cops he'd intended to stone. I thought I'd support the movement the way I had become accustomed to, by donating money, and then telling people I donated twice as much. The moment I sent off my contributions, I saw the protest differently, for now I had done something and could feel superior to those who hadn't. In the early days of the protest, it was looting, and the news coverage made me anxious. My fear was that my favorite stores would be emptied, and that when the city finally opened back up again after the COVID restrictions, there'd be nothing left for me to buy. Amy shared my concern, so we left Union Square and walked to Soho, where two of the shops we most cared about were located. Both were boarded up, but I wasn't sure if it was preventative or the result of smashed windows. "It's not like I really need anything," I said sulkily as we headed back uptown. Neither of us had ever gone so long without shopping. Close to 100 days it had been. And I wasn't quite sure who I was anymore. When my agent's birthday rolled around, I wound up giving her two bottles of wine and a gift card from a pharmacy she likes. Those are like presents that Lisa would come up with, I said to Amy. She's not necessarily cheap, our sister, just unimaginative. And cheap. There were just so many questions I wanted answered. How, for instance, did people find the shoe style they were looking for, let alone the proper size, when looting big Nike stores? You're an amateur, wandering around a massive, probably dark stock room with 10 minutes at most, while the sales clerks, who are pros, seem to need twice that amount of time, I said to Amy. Just then, we ran into a protest march, an actual moving one. It was headed our way west on Houston Street, so we joined it. Again, it was hard to estimate the crowd size, 1,000 people, more. Social distancing was in practice, sort of, and most everyone I saw had the lower half of their face covered. In this particular case, I actually welcomed my mask as it relieved some of the pressure of chanting, which is something I have never been comfortable with. It's the same with prayer and the Pledge of Allegiance. I even lip-sync happy birthday. So was glad that my mouth was obscured and no one could see whether or not I was joining in. Hey, hey, ho, ho, racist cops have got to go, the crowd shouted as Amy and I merged into it. This template has been around since the 1950s and has to be my least favorite. True, it can easily be tailored to any cause, but you always know the word that's going to rhyme with ho will be go. It's lazy. Next came whose streets? Our streets. Then it was NYPD suck my dick. And I'm not sure how I feel about that one. Is someone performing fellatio on you really the greatest punishment you can imagine? I wanted to ask. Black Lives Matter followed next. And then we were back to whose streets? Our streets. It's always interesting to watch a chant die, like a match going out. Some can burn for decent stretches of time, but with this crowd, there appeared to be a strict 45-second policy. Everyone seemed to have their phones out, and I noticed a lot of people taking selfies. This struck me as vulgar, but what isn't a background for an Instagram post anymore? I know that people are now taking pictures of themselves at funerals because when I looked up selfies at, funerals was the third option Google gave me. I clicked on it, aghast to find mourners posing beside the caskets of their dead friends and relatives. Some people had their thumbs up. Meaning what exactly? Great embalming job. Great death. The march moved west and then turned north onto LaGuardia Place. It bottlenecked at Washington Square Park, so Amy and I took our leave. I walked her home and then continued on foot to my place, another 53 blocks north. As the days passed and the marches became ubiquitous, I grew to think of them much the way I do about buses and subways. I'll just take this BLM down to 23rd Street. The people were friendly, the snacks plentiful, and it felt good to walk in the middle of the avenue. At 23rd, I might wait an hour or so before catching another BLM back home or cross town to the west side. While marching, I'd look at the people around me and wonder what they were thinking. It's like at the symphony. I always assumed that the audience was comparing this rendition of, say, Mahler's Second to a superior one. Then I started asking around and learned that people were entertaining the same crazy thoughts I was. How long would it take me to eat all of my clothes? Not the zippers and buttons, but just the fabric. If I had to do it in 6 months, could I? If you shredded a sport coat very finely and added half a cup to, say, stuffing, would your body even notice it? I felt sure that while marching, everyone around me thought of racism and of the many black Americans who have been killed by the police over the years. We who were white likely considered our own complicity, or rather we touched on it briefly, that exposed wire, before moving on to other people who were much worse than we were. But then the time stretched on, and our thoughts strayed, didn't they? Something I thought of one afternoon, marching uptown with a sizable crowd, was a well-known movie actor who had contacted me almost 30 years earlier when Hugh and I lived in Soho. He wanted me to come by his house to discuss a possible collaboration, and I was flattered, for I had never met anyone famous. It was snowing, and almost 3 feet had accumulated by the time I left my apartment. The actor didn't live far from me, half a mile maybe, but getting to his house was a real pain, given my short legs and the waterproof boots I didn't have. I arrived to find his two young children, a boy and a girl, in the dining room, being served by a thin black woman whose hair was covered with a do-rag. She said hello to me as we passed by, and I noticed the steam coming off the soup she was setting down. "You're lucky she came to work in weather like this," I said to the actor as we made our way to the living room, "and on a Saturday, no less." He offered a thin smile. "Actually, that's my wife." My face still burns to think of this. But if nothing else, it taught me a lesson. From that day on, whenever I go to someone's house and see a person of a different race working either inside or outside, I say, "Is that your husband?" Or, "How come you make your wife do all the cleaning?" They always answer, "Conchita, my wife, she's like 20 years older than me and has 4 kids. Plus, I'm already married to a man." Eventually, though, I'll be right. And my host will say, "May I just thank you for being the one person in my life who's not a horrible racist?" As the weeks passed, I saw more and more protest signs reading, "Defund the police." That won't be doing us much good come election time, I thought, worried how this would play on Fox News. "The left wants it so that when armed thugs break into your house and you dial 911, you'll get a recording of rich homie Quan laughing at you." Amy worried too. It wasn't taking money allocated for law enforcement and redirecting it toward social services that bothered her. Rather, it was the language and how Trump would use it to scare people. He'd already started, and I imagined that leading up to the election, he would just keep hammering at it. "Then there are all the statues being pulled down," Amy said, when she and Adam arrived on Emerald Isle. "I thought it would be nearly impossible, that they were like screwed into the ground or something. But I guess all you need is some really good rope and a dozen or so really mad people." "Mad, strong people," Adam added. "I'm not sure the general public really pays all that much attention to statues," I said. "Don't you think you could come in the night and replace General Braxton Bragg's head with that of, say, Whoopi Goldberg, and it would take months for anyone to notice? Don't most of us see a bronze figure on a pedestal and think simply statue?" Amy guessed that I was right. "For those few exceptions who pay closer attention, you could keep the monument and change the plaque," I said. "It could read something like Chester Beauregard Jr., unfortunate blacksmith who bore a striking resemblance to the traitor General Braxton Bragg." My friend Asya, who is Jewish, thought otherwise when I brought up the issue on the phone the next day. If there were statues of famous Nazis around, even ones with replaced heads and nameplates, I still wouldn't want to pass them every day, she said. I mean, ugh, what a slap in the face. I see her point. To those upset about the monuments that were recently toppled, I guess I'd say, look, times change. Jefferson Davis overlooked your godforsaken traffic circle for 100 years. Now we'll put him in storage and make it someone else's turn for a while. Who could argue with that? I asked my friends, John and Lynette, who have a house not far from the C-section. I thought the streets in our neighborhood were named after the developer's children, but it seems I was wrong. That's Lee Avenue, as in Robert E., John said. Stewart Avenue is in Jeb. Jackson, as in Stonewall. When I repeated this to Amy, she said, "What about Scotch Bonnet Drive?" That's after General Jedediah Scotch Bonnet, I told her. Then there was a street called Coon Crossing. A year earlier, I might have thought nothing of it, but everything was getting a second look now. I was surprised to learn that John and Lynette's neighborhood in Raleigh, Cameron Village, was now simply called the Village District. This because the Cameron it was named after had been a plantation owner. This made me wonder about the men behind my elementary and high schools. Who was E.C. Brooks? Jesse Sanderson. In the meantime, Uncle Ben's rice was now called Ben's Original. The box was still orange, but there was no longer a face on it. Eskimo pies disappeared as well. I was fine with all this Black Lives Matter stuff till they went after both Aunt Jemima and Mrs. Butterworth, our friend Burmy said. Now I'm like, hey, don't mess with my syrup. One of the many shops on the island that sells inflatable rafts and inexpensive clothing had a Confederate flag beach towel in its window. I saw a fair number of those in eastern North Carolina. Some were discreet, a decal on a windshield, and others were loud, full-sized standards billowing in front of houses, often beside a Trump flag, or affixed to massive pickup trucks that would tear up and down the main road. The trucks were unnaturally high off the ground and most often had jacked-up front wheels that were made to look like they were forever going uphill. Carolina squats, they were called, or bro-dozers. Their mufflers had been modified as well, or perhaps they'd been removed altogether. Engines roared as if to say, "Asshole coming through!" Should there be any doubt that the driver was insecure regarding his masculinity, one could often find a pair of lemon-sized testicles dangling from the trailer hitch. "Lord, son," Burmy said when, astonished, I described them to him. "You ain't never seen truck nuts." I was 8 when we moved south from New York. It was the first time I heard the words Yankee and rebel. In school, at Cub Scouts and the country club, you were either on one side or the other. People who win the war move on. People who lose turn their flags into beach towels and hang hard rubber testicles from their bumpers. They make it easy for the rest of us to hide. "Over there," we say, pointing to a bro-dozer with a Confederate flag affixed to it. "That's what a racist looks like." When I was in 7th grade, I acted as a campaign manager for Dwight Bunch, one of the 3 Black students at Carroll Junior High. He ran for class president and won with my brilliant slogan, "We like Dwight a bunch." 2 years later, our school was desegregated. Fights broke out in the parking lot. My friend Ted had his nose broken with a Coke bottle. In our 20s, we both dated a number of Black guys, which I always thought made us the opposite of racists. I didn't have sex with them because of their color, but just because they were there and willing. Now I was reading that sleeping with Black guys meant you were racist, that you were exoticizing them. Everything was suspect, and everywhere you turned, there was an article titled "Blank's Race Problem." It could be about anyone, an actor who'd never had a co-star of color, a comedian who used the word Negro 20 years ago. The articles were always written by white people in their early 20s. I saw the phrase POC, white passing, in the signature of an email someone sent and wondered how long that had been a thing. Reckoning was the word I kept hearing. It was time for a racial reckoning. We stayed at the beach for 2 weeks and returned to New York just as the protests had petered out into bike riding opportunities. Flash mobs of predominantly white people would pedal up the avenues, 3,000 strong, blocking traffic, chanting, "Whose streets? Our streets!" And occasionally, "Black Lives Matter!" But strangely, in a sing-songy way, the way a fisherman might call, "Fresh caught haddock." I came upon a bike march one Saturday afternoon, the last day of spring, at around 5 o'clock. People lined Third Avenue, most raising their phones to shoot pictures and videos, or to turn their backs on the cyclists and take selfies. Beside me stood two white girls in their early 20s, both frantically texting. Both had tans. "Where can we get bikes?" one asked the other. She tugged down her mask and commenced filming herself. "Black Lives Matter!" she shouted. "Woo!" "How do I get across?" asked a frail-looking elderly woman who had suddenly appeared beside me. Her rust-colored wig was pulled down low on her forehead, and she wore a sun visor. In her hand was a heavy-looking bag from the nearby drugstore. "You wait until these people are done," snapped one of the suntan girls. I, who, of course, needed to pee, was wondering the same thing. How might I cross? How do all of us get to the other side? We do have a few minutes here. If anybody has any questions, you don't have to. You can bring the lights up a bit. There we go. Oh, yes, you have a question.
Hi. I wanted to ask about languages. I read in your books that you often learn a bit of the language when you go to another country. What's your favourite language to speak? And is it worth the bother of learning something before you go?
Well, Hugh and I are going to Japan in a few weeks. And I've been studying Japanese hard. And I'll say something to Hugh. I'll say, "Oh, did you know that this is how you say?" And he says, "We're only going for 4 days." And that's true, but I don't know, it just makes the trip so much richer. And sometimes Hugh and I will be sitting there and I'll say, "The person at the next table said 3. I think she's been married 3 times. But what's fascinating to me about this new program that I'm studying is that there are questions like, who is his husband? And is that her wife by the door? But they don't have same-sex marriage there. But it's just trying to impose it, you know, the language program. And my friend Mike is using the same program for Yiddish. And one of the phrases that it taught him was, "My uncle is a broken man." And also it taught him, "Who here smells like fish?" Yes.
I just wanted to share with you an anecdote from this afternoon. I was trying to tell my son who I was going to see this afternoon, and I said, "I'm going to see an American essayist." And he said, "They let Americans into the SAS?"
Please let that make the radio show. Thank you.
Meet David Sedaris was written and read by David Sedaris. The producer was Steve Doherty, and it was a Giddy Goat production for the BBC.
And there it was, it made the cut. David will be back with more stories at the same time next week. And straight to another storyteller, Chelsea will be spinning a good historical yarn in the Archers next this evening, just after the news.
Six Music.
The year is 1978. Kate Bush releases her seminal debut album,
The Kick Inside. And on the record's 45th anniversary, we're celebrating the icon that is Kate Bush.
Six Music's deep dive into The Kick Inside.
You can find archive interviews and exclusive performances, as well as playlists and programmes featuring artists she's inspired.
She was in her own world that she had created herself.
Way, way ahead of their time.
For all this and more, open BBC Sounds, click the music tab and scroll to find Kate Bush's Artist Icons collection.